Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, we have thoughts on the USA series Mr. Robot as it wraps up its first season, and we'll try to figure out how many of them we can share without spoiling all of its twisty goodness. Then we'll use one of Mr. Robot's many charms, its title sequence, to jump to the topic of how shows and movies introduce themselves and how that task is changing as the way we watch changes. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Heads up, Hidden Brain is the brand new NPR podcast about social science you can apply throughout your life. Get a preview of Shankar Vedantam's Hidden Brain podcast beginning September 4th and learn about why arguments sometimes get off track. Find the Hidden Brain podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We have hackers and credits on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is Chris Klimek. Chris, when you're not here in Studio 44, what do you do?
I write about movies and such, often for you.
That's right. First up this week is one of the most talked-up shows of the summer, USA's Mr. Robot. It's about to close its 10-part season. As we tape this, that finale will have aired by the time you're listening to it. It's already been renewed for a second season. This show follows a young hacker whose name is Elliot, played by the wonderful Rami Malek, who winds up embroiled in not just one, but multiple complicated schemes that are either planned or complicated by a group called F Society, and its leader, played by Christian Slater, the titular Mr. Robot. The creator, Sam Esmail, has never done a TV show before, so this is quite a debut. They showed it at South by Southwest. They showed it at Tribeca, trying to build it up. So we wanted to talk about it just as it's about to wrap up. Now, we should mention also, originally, its finale was supposed to air last week, owing to some similarities between a scene in the finale and the tragic shooting in Virginia, the on-air shooting last week. They chose to delay it a week, so that's why it's going to be airing this week between when we're taping and when you'll get to hear this. So, Stephen, I know that you had started watching this. We made mention of it last week.
Yeah.
And you had originally brought it as one of your summer catch-ups that you were enjoying.
Yeah, it's a show that I've been watching for a little while. The first couple episodes, I watched the first one and was immediately hooked and was like, oh, I can't wait to see where this twisty, turny, kind of paranoid thriller goes. And as I've watched through, I'm now into my seventh episode, not quite done with the seventh episode. It is creepy as hell. At times, legitimately unsettling to watch. I love the show, but it's a show that I've been watching. It's one that I've happened to watch on my computer through headphones. It's already built around the narration of this lead character, mm-hmm. who is not necessarily a reliable narrator, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, more, but also it's these paranoid, in some cases, delusional ramblings that gets into your head. This is a show I'm trying to pace myself on.
Right. Chris, how do you feel about this show?
Domo arigato for asking, first of all. I really like it. This show feels distinctly millennial for me, and when I say that, I don't mean for millennials. I mean everything that it reminds me of is circa 99, 2000, when we thought that the Y2K bug was going to make our pencils and screwdrivers stop working along with everything else. I think of The Matrix, 99. I think of Fight Club, 99. I think of American Psycho, which was either 99 or 2000. Mm-hmm. Kind of combines elements of all these things. But I think visually, as well as thematically, and the way we can't trust our narrator entirely, I'm kind of dancing around.
Right. I think we should not give away anything major, but I think it's premise and not outcome to say, there's a lot going on with this guy, and you are getting his perspective, and you often are led to question what exactly is going on and whether his perspective is reliable.
It seems to me that the only character on this show who would have headlined a TV show maybe 20, 25 years ago is Angela, his friend, mm-hmm. who's the girl who's known him since childhood, and he and she share a similar tragedy in their background. I don't know. I guess she's the closest thing that we have to an audience surrogate because she understands the least about what's going on, but she's very earnest.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Trying to solve this mystery of her own, and he's kind of trying to help her but also protect her. And I don't know, there's just sort of a good comparison there of the way that the protagonist of a TV show has evolved over the course of a generation. Were the state of computing in 1990 capable of sustaining it?
Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
I wasn't necessarily hooked after the first episode. I liked it, but I wasn't necessarily hooked because if you are watching this very cursorily, as a lot of people watch a lot of USA television shows, like your Suits, your White Collars, your Burn Notices, your Royal Pains, those don't ask a lot of you.
Right.
As a USA brand, they are made to watch while you're folding laundry or checking Twitter, as I do. So a scene would start, and I'd think, I know where this scene's going. I know what this scene is doing, and then something would happen. Over and over again, these predictable beats get exploded. If you are just watching the very first part of the first episode, you see him coming in as a super hacker who solves crimes or punishes guilty people.
Yeah, he actually says the words vigilante hacker.
Exactly. And you start to think, okay, this is a USA show. But try to imagine this show without Rami Malek in the lead. This guy is the show's haunted, creepy, unsettled vibe. I mean, this kid's face is a Belle and Sebastian album. Yeah. This guy looks like he was lifted out of... Did you ever see Tim Burton's sketchbooks with those characters with deep circles under their eyes?
Yeah.
This kid was just cut and pasted
has a look, for sure. He's very in tune with the aesthetic of the show.
Absolutely.
He does an incredible amount of acting with his eyes.
Of course, yes.
This is it. Because, again, if you're watching this cursorily, you see a guy in the center of the screen not moving. He has his physicality, this character, is very still. So if you're not looking very deeply, you're going to see, like, acting is reacting, and he's not reacting to anybody.
Right.
But if you see these eyes, which take up conservatively 63% of his face, see this emotional turmoil, and we get into it. It's fascinating to me. I mean, again, if there's a moment that is rote, it gets upended almost immediately. It's a weirder show than I gave it credit for, and I really like it because of that.
Yeah. I think one of the other things about this show is it is aesthetically much more inventive than a lot of television traditionally has been. You've seen certainly shows like Mad Men and Breaking Bad that have a lot of interesting directorial choices, and that goes back to The Sopranos and other stuff like that. But this is a show that is fascinated with framing of shots.
Yeah.
And that's been talked about by a bunch of people, but it's conspicuous enough that's supposed to be noticeable by normals. And that's one of the things I like about it. I think it is conspicuous enough that even if you're not trained in film aesthetic, you're supposed to be able to notice that people are not in the frame in the place where you normally find people in the frame of a shot.
Right.
Specifically, a couple of choices, one of which is people are very often on the very edge of frames.
Yeah.
Kind of awkwardly only partly in the shot. You'll see someone's head, but not the way you would normally see a kind of head and shoulder
shot. You almost don't even see the underside of chins in some shots.
People are cut off in odd and unexpected ways. The other one is very often when you have someone speaking to another person, the traditional way to set that shot up is if only one of the people is in the shot, they will be framed, and you do this with photography too, where the direction that you're looking is where you leave the space.
Mm-hmm.
So the person will be, as you're looking at it, the person will be on the right side of the shot talking to the left, right? They like to do conversations here so that the person is on the wrong side talking to the edge of the frame so that you get less of the sense of the conversation between the people and more of the sense that all these people are kind of disconnected from each other. And what it is, it contributes to what Stephen was calling unsettling, the unsettling nature of the show, because you're seeing people framed how they're not supposed to be framed. Shots are set up how they're not supposed to be set up. When I say supposed to, I mean in terms of what your mind expects, so that your mind can place people in space. Your eye places people in space based on its interpretation of camera work. And when you see it done differently, it's unsettling in that way that Steven's talking about.
They also do a lot with very jarring music. There's some nicely employed songs here and there, like they'll drop a Cure song at an appropriate point. But there's also just that, like, kind of that, like, Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross kind of, like, that establishes how nervy a situation is.
Right.
Chris made an interesting point about this show having the sensibility of, like, a late 90s, early aughts. Just even, like, a hacker thing in general feels very, like, the net, you know?
I saw it described today as cyberpunk, which I hadn't thought of, but I guess that's fair, sort of.
In
some ways. Yeah.
And where I would come at that point is there are elements of this show that are eerily current. there's a reference very early on in the series to the Ashley Madison situation. I mean, before Ashley Madison was hacked, they reference Ashley Madison. There are a lot of these, the Sony hack, you can really feel where like the impact of a hack is very clear.
On corporations in particular.
On corporations. And a lot of, at first, I really had this, I thought I had this show pegged where, you know, they have the gigantic evil corporation, which is actually referred, it's E-Corp, and they refer to it as Evil Corp throughout.
There's kind of an explanation for that.
Right.
That goes a little bit back to the
But the fact that everyone else does it too, and when you hear a television anchor say it, they refer to it as Evil Corp. So that's a cool device.
Which is a cool device in part to establish that Elliot is not necessarily a reliable narrator.
Yeah.
Right.
But at first there's this kind of like, wake up, sheeple, to it that you think you have
pegged. Yeah, but it's not that show.
And it's not that show. No. And I'm so glad it's not that show.
It's a show about implication. It's about being implicated in this world and not having clear good versus evil. There are big reveals. There are big twists. But thankfully, they're not the show. The show continues. The show deepens. The show gets more complex as these reveals happen. What do you guys think of how it's treating the women on the show? With one exception, I think it's doing a really good job. We can't talk about that one exception, but they start out in their slots. There is the supportive best friend. There's the drug dealer with a heart of gold.
Mm-hmm.
But every one of them gets time by themselves to, again, deepen and surprise. I really think this is doing a good job with the women characters.
I think it is. Glenn, when you were talking about watching this show with essentially only part of your attention and how difficult that is, I don't think I've seen a show since The Wire that required me so much to try to keep track of everything.
Yeah.
And where I would go back at the end of an episode and read a really good recap just to make sure that I caught everything.
Yeah.
And I think that density is a positive quality. But I will say, and when you talk about the women in the story, it reminds me of kind of just how much is going on. I do think there are times when, at the very least, they are right on the edge of this kind of getting away from them in terms of their ability to organize it and keep the narrative moving forward in a way that's comprehensible.
Yeah.
I think there are times when I sort of feel like now there aren't enough signposts for what you're trying to do. It's not a dumbing down thing. It's just a narrative organization is a skill. And again, this is a guy who's never done a television show before. And I do think there are moments when I think, I wish you had a tiny bit more old school television in you, because there's a place for that skill. And I think there are moments where it's a little too kind of punky and out there
for me. It takes a few like lengthy detours for like drug fueled freak out.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel like you're getting farther and farther away from it. And and of course it'll do that at a point when you are most invested in what has actually happened. And there's one episode in particular where you're just waiting to be pulled back into a linear narrative.
Yeah.
It is the word I keep coming back to is unsettling.
Yeah. Other thoughts, Chris?
One thing I hope the show will start to reckon with a little bit more than it has to the point that I've seen is having people react to this incredible violation of being hacked, that the way that he just compulsively hacks everyone, you know, his psychiatrist, his best friend, all of his colleagues, you know, no one, he just, when he discloses this to someone, really confiding in them, confessing, you know, that this is just what he does.
How he relates to people.
Yeah. But no one has yet reacted to this, like, wow, I'm incredibly violated by this.
It's a very interesting thing because, like, I think that what Stephen was saying about how current it is, I react to that kind of theme in this show that I think its vision of hacking is current enough. I am not enough of an expert to be able to say, could you really hack this kind of facility in this way exactly the way that they do it? But it feels plausible, which, film and television for a very long time had a reputation for not being able to represent hackers in any way that had any semblance of reality to it. It feels real enough to me that it feels like the kind of stuff that at the very least you would fear would happen to your phone, to your computer, whatever. It looks right enough. It looks right-ish enough to scare you, which a lot of hacking stuff
has. I mean, I'm not even talking about unlocking jail cell doors. You know, I just mean like my email, you know, the stuff that would really hurt you personally.
And that's kind of what I mean is I think that one of the things I like about the currency of it is that because it's things that seem plausible to happen, you get that feeling of like, that'd be real creepy. That'd be real creepy if your friend was doing that. I do want to mention one other thing, which is there was a piece in BuzzFeed by an actor named Amir Talai, who is a kind of a character actor. He's been in a bunch of stuff. He was one of the buddies in What to Expect When You're Expecting. And he wrote a piece at BuzzFeed called When a Brown Actor Plays a White Character, Who Really Wins? And it's absolutely fascinating because It talks about the fact that Rami Malek is in this show, is of Egyptian heritage, and is named Elliot. And he kind of talks about kind of not acknowledging the background of the actor when you build the character. It's super fascinating. When I read it, I kind of had this 50-50 reaction to it. Like, I agree with parts of this. I don't know if I agree with other parts of it. It's fascinating. Again, it's at BuzzFeed, and I really liked it. All right. Well, I will be interested to hear. I know that many of you are enjoying some Mr. Robot this summer. I'll be interested to hear what you think. And of course, it will be time for finale talk. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or find us on Twitter at NPRPCHH and tell us how you feel about how Mr. Robot ended its first season and will you be tuning in for the second season.
But tell us without spoiling anything. Some people are behind.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. As always. Well, when we come back, you know, Mr. Robot has a great little thing it does with its title. And we thought we would use that to jump off and talk about title sequences. So we're going to do that when we come back, so don't go away.
NPR is supported by Target with the Made to Matter Handpicked by Target collection. Better for you brands like Cascadian Farm, Stonyfield, Plum Organics, Method, and more are available to explore in-store and at target.com/made to matter.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about Mr. Robot. And one of the things about Mr. Robot is that every week it has a slightly different shot that it uses as its kind of, would we say, title card?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has, of course, the show's logo, which reminds me of an Atari game.
Yeah.
And they do a bunch of interesting things with it. So we thought we would talk a little bit about title sequences. I'm going to start with Stephen Thompson. Title sequences. Do you have thoughts on thoughts?
Well, I think that, as you said, Mr. Robot is a perfect starting point here because those title cards, which sometimes have a little bit of scene leading into them, and sometimes it just drops it right at the beginning, it is setting a tone. And that is the most important job of, you know, not only a title card, but any kind of credit sequence that comes at the beginning of a show or a movie.
Front matter.
Yeah. You are trying to get a sense of what you're about to see, and you want to be pulled into that place as quickly as possible. And so the first moments of Mr. Robot, my blood pressure rises.
Mm-hmm.
And the show is engineered, and the opening of the show is engineered to do that. You are tense right away in the opening seconds of that show.
Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
Well, we talked about some of this before. We had a show about title sequences
on TV. We had one about TV credit sequences. We'll link to that.
It mostly devolved into a singing theme song.
It did.
There's a lot of Weldon singing in that show. More than I had remembered.
There is.
Neither here nor there. You know, we're in the era of the title card now. Lost started it off, I think. Just dropping it in without a theme, without anybody telling us any stories. Just the title card. Difficult People does it. Broad City does it famously, and I think very effectively. The title sequence that I went back to was a movie one because I saw it when I was 7 years old, and it has invaded my head, and that is the Star Wars title sequence. Now, it starts,
You're referring to the film The Star Wars.
I am. The War of Stars, yes. Mm-hmm. It starts with a 20th Century Fox logo and then goes to this single line that is very mythic and subdued almost a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, bringing in all this mythic stuff, all this Joseph Campbell crap. And then we get this bombast, the John Williams score kicks in, and we see these giant words, Star Wars descending. Now, I had the album storybook of Star Wars, which I listened to before going to see it. And unusually, they had that 20th Century Fox fanfare on the storybook, which didn't make any sense at all. But it does, because that's part of the process. That's why whenever I see any crappy Fox movie, I still get that little bit of goosebumps. Because, like, is it possible? Could it be? No, it's not that.
No, see, I have that too, but if it's followed, especially by the Lucasfilm logo, like
with the
glowy green,
that's,
you know,
right,
pixels,
you need
like
too,
flowing through it. Right. But I mean, the Fox logo, that could be Alien, that could be Die Hard. So I mean, it has that kind of fight or flight effect on me, no matter how bad the movie that I'm about to see is. I'm like,
Wow. I didn't know anybody reacted to Studio cards that way.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, they fuss with them, too. They'll add, like, the DreamWorks thing.
Right.
Like, DreamWorks likes to clown around, and if it's Shrek, they'll plop, you know, ogre boogers.
The press screening for the last X-Men movie that came out last year, they did an animation with the Fox logo in front of it where the rest of the image fades and just the X and Fox stays illuminated for a second and people applauded.
Goodness. We're starved.
We are starved. One of the things I was thinking about was how a lot of times the credit sequences have now moved to the end of movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in addition to the fact that you'll obviously get, I mean, sometimes they do bloopers, like in Bring It On, they have a bunch of outtakes, which are fun. And I think the idea is keep people from leaving.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And hopefully they'll actually see more of the credits. But you also get stuff like in Spy, at the end of Spy.
Yeah, I was gonna bring up Spy.
You get a whole bunch of new jokes. There's kind of a use of graphics to do a bunch of new jokes. I thought that was very cool.
What is the Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg, the other guys?
Mm-hmm.
You took me to see that on my birthday a couple years ago. But this is a cop movie, a parody cop movie that deals with financial crime. And over the end titles, there is actually a remarkably clear, cogent explanation of how a pyramid scheme works, where they're basically explaining what Bernie Madoff did. And it's great. It's like the best PowerPoint well, no PowerPoint is good. But it's remarkable how well they communicate the nature of the crime over the end titles.
Well, I think it's an interesting point, the way that so many movie credits have now just drifted to the back of films. I feel like in part of it, it is just, you've sat through a bunch of previews and people are sitting there like, get me to the movie.
Right.
Like, I want to see movie. I don't want to wait through. Like when you watch like a Woody Allen movie and it's just names on a black, white lettering on a black backboard. You're just like, get to the movie. You know, because there's some like old jazz song and you just feel like you've seen this movie 30 times because every single one of his movies does that exact same thing.
Yes.
So I like the way movies and, you know, TV shows do this too, of just like, kick right into a scene. Just give me a scene. Get started.
There are certainly movies where they decide that they're going to have fun with that opening sequence.
Yeah.
The beginning of My Best Friend's Wedding has a whole little musical number.
Is that a cartoon?
No. It's just these women singing Wishin' and Hopin', but they're not women from the movie. It's just a little group of women. It sets this tone of kind of like light parody of the desire to get married and fall in love. But at the same time, it is that.
Yeah.
It's the thing that I often talk about, which is both the thing and the send-up of the thing.
Sure.
One of my favorites is the beginning of Catch Me If You Can.
I was going to mention that one too. Love that.
And that's, of course, based on the old Saul Bass.
Right.
Credit sequences for all manner of things. And so it has kind of the little silhouette shapes and it's very graphic and they're playing around with that. But the Catch Me If You Can one is really high end. I love that.
Well, and that has such an uncharacteristic and wonderful John Williams score also. And I mean, I love, you know, the marches and the heroic stuff and, you know, Raiders and Superman and all that. But that is a much more subtle kind of jazzy John Williams cue that's playing over that sequence.
I think that's an underappreciated credit sequence for an underappreciated movie.
To me. Well, I am very, very protective of film title sequences. I will watch them by themselves. I will watch compilations of them. To me, it is like the airlock that you are passing through into this fictional world. It is the hypnotist telling you, you will suspend your disbelief. So when you guys did the TV version of this 3 years ago, Glenn attempted a taxonomy of TV title sequence varieties. I have tried to do the cinematic equivalent.
Bless your heart.
All right, so there's a little bit of overlap among these. All right, so the first variety I have called the tastemaker. Now, this is where the filmmaker is just free to show off their taste, freed of the burden of telling a story, and it is purely sensual. I would put the Catch Me If You Can title sequence in this story. And, of course, you mentioned, Linda, that was paying homage to Saul Bass's title design for some Hitchcock films. So I thought of the one from North by Northwest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Maybe we can hear a little bit of that Bernard Herrmann score, since it doesn't make you wait. It just comes right in.
It sure does.
It's a very graphic representation of arrows and travel and motion. And, you know, North by Northwest is kind of the template for the modern action movie in a lot of ways. And that's represented graphically in these titles. There's a variety that I called the narrator, where the title sequence basically functions as exposition.
Sure.
We're doing some table setting that you need. You guys know the film JCVD, wherein Jean-Claude Van Damme plays himself?
Oh, right.
I know of it.
Okay, well, opens with this three and a half minute single take action sequence over the Baby Huey song, Hard Times from the 70s, great song. We see Jean-Claude going through this elaborate action scene. It could have started like any of his other movies, and not till someone blows their cue is there the reveal that he is playing an actor, he's playing himself, he's shooting a movie.
Nice.
So that tells us right away. I mean, we get misdirection right there in the space of 3.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. This is not the movie you thought you were going to see. And there's the music video. So the title sequence that is basically just a music video for a great song, again, whether it's something that's just very well chosen or something written for the film.
Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man?
Shaft!
Can you dig it?
Theme from Shaft, obviously written for the movie Shaft.
How can you tell?
Parenthesis, theme from.
As it is.
It's not just the song Shaft was out there, and they were like, someone should make this into a movie.
The opening titles of Jackie Brown.
It's right here, written down.
Okay, right, where Tarantino is paying homage, maybe to The Graduate, which is the same shot of mm-hmm. Dustin Hoffman on the moving sidewalk at mm-hmm. LAX. But I think it's done better, even though there's the famous The Sounds of Silence is playing over The Graduate 30 years later, when we have Jackie Brown as this aging airline stewardess with a criminal record who's kind of hit a dead end in life. The song is Bobby Womack's Across 110th Street, which is about drugs and prostitution and the cycle of poverty.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight.
For the longest time, the shot just holds on her to the right of the frame, standing on the sidewalk. It's a really smart introduction to her.
It holds on her face because she is the movie. We want to look in this amazing face and see everything we see. And Tarantino is in love with her as well, just like we are.
Finally, I'll skip ahead. I have one. Okay, the
Chris
last
has a
one.
Stack of papers.
I do.
Ruffles through his papers.
The one that I think that I appreciate the most, just because it is most invested in rewatchability, it shows so much confidence that you are going to like this film enough to revisit it, is the one that I call The Impressionist, where there is a kernel of the film that will not make sense to you until you have actually seen the film. At the risk of talking about this thing too much, Terminator 2 has a great opening title sequence, and only because it is such an anomalous bit of imagery for a movie like that. It is a playground on fire. Mm-hmm. And only after you've seen the film do you realize that Sarah Connor, who is haunted by her foreknowledge of the nuclear apocalypse, has this dream every night where she's, you know, looking through a chain link fence and seeing children on a playground, and then the sky explodes and the world burns. But that's all you get at the beginning of the movie, is just this playground equipment burning. It's poetic, it's creepy, it's memorable, and it's kind of a curveball at the top of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. So yeah. I think that's a great
title. Let me name a film and you tell me where it fits. Yeah. Now, The Shining starts with a overhead shot of them driving up to this hotel just incredibly gorgeous vistas, because this entire film is going to take place within the hotel. So mm-hmm. we're about to go from the world to this incredibly huge,
closed
yet
system.
Still yeah. closed system. It's still kind of claustrophobic thing. It's basically telling you the opposite of what this movie is.
Right.
So what would that be? Impressionistic?
Yeah, probably. Since that some of that footage gets put at the end of Blade Runner again
sure.
later.
That's true. Touch of Evil?
Well, Touch of Evil, I'm going to say, is...
Explain a little about what that looks
Touch
like.
Touch of Evil is an Orson Welles film which begins with one long take of the scene at the border between Mexico and the United States, and somebody
right.
puts a bomb in a car.
In a car,
at the very
and we
beginning.
See the car cross the border,
mm-hmm.
right?
And it's just this amazing tracking shot that just goes on forever without a cut, and it just is pure suspense. It is pure, yeah. unbearable suspense. What would you call it?
Maybe the exposition one?
Where do you categorize the Pink Panther movies?
Yeah.
It's just a cartoon panther wandering around.
I'm going to call that the tastemaker. The first category.
All right.
So before we leave this topic, you know I love the people. So I did a little experiment, and while we're all sitting here, I asked Twitter, what's your favorite title
oh,
sequence?
Look at that.
Wow.
Right? If you're hearing my phone vibrate, that's why. My phone is blowing up. We got 7. We got Catch Me If You Can.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of love for Christmas Vacation.
Hmm.
Wow.
Don't remember that one
yeah,
myself.
I watched that in the last couple of years, and I don't remember
the title. We'll have to look it up. But Spy Hard, Anatomy of a Murder, and Sneakers, The Naked Gun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A couple of votes for
Anatomy
of a Murder.
Well, that whole police squad setup is very fun.
A good number of votes for Watchmen. People share my love for Catch Me If You Can, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Sure.
Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Don't know which one that is. Which of the two?
I would guess it's the David Fincher because it's the Atticus Ross, Karen O cover of a Led Zeppelin song. I can't remember which one.
I suspect so too. Devil Wears Prada, Terminator 2 Judgment Day,
Chris Klimek,
Down with Love, Enter the Void, Fight Club, Zombieland, Panic Room. Two votes for Panic Room.
Pretty much every David Fincher movie is in this category.
I think it checks out.
Run, Lola, Run.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And My Best Friend's Wedding.
There you go.
So someone came through for me on My Best Friend's Wedding. And the great John Ross Bowie weighed in to say Shaft.
There you go.
So there you go, Chris.
I'm talking about Shaft.
That's right.
Yes, you are.
We did very well with that. I appreciate it, Twitter. If you were part of that burst of answers, you helped me with my little
spring. Now you won't have to yell at us for forgetting your movie.
That's right. Or at the very least, you didn't tweet it enough times, I guess, if we forgot it. All right. When we come back, we're going to come to our favorite part of the show. What is making us happy this week? We will be right back.
Heads up. Hidden Brain is the brand new NPR podcast about social science you can apply throughout your life. Get a preview of Shankar Vedantam's Hidden Brain podcast beginning September 4th and learn about why arguments sometimes get off track. Find the Hidden Brain podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, first of all, last week on the show, I did a little call out for recommendations for horror and horror adjacent movies and TV shows that would be at least somewhat appropriate for my 11-year-old daughter, who is obsessed.
Scary stuff.
Who is obsessed with violence and gore the way you hope your 11-year-old will take an interest. And I've gotten this wonderful, warm-hearted flood of suggestions. I've had several people email me large lists, which have been extremely useful. And it's really helped give shape to this idea. And I think I'm sure we'll do more with this topic soon. But one of the ideas that's kind of come out of this is I've been getting bogged down in what slasher movie should my 11-year-old watch?
Right.
In part because her initial interest was in Sinister 2.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of people have brought out are kitschy, campy, monster movies.
Yeah, sure.
And suspense, Goosebumps is nothing if not the Twilight Zone.
Right.
And so getting her into TV shows that play on bumps and scares and stuff, I think is a really nice way to go about it. Also, it occurred to me along the way that her two favorite movies of all time are Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice, both of which are directed by Tim Burton.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tim Burton movies like Mars Attacks make a certain amount of sense. Edward Scissorhands makes a certain amount of sense. And so I'm really excited to have this huge well of movie and TV ideas.
People really rallied.
So were there consensus picks? What did people say?
I'm still gathering them all up.
There was a lot.
It's a lot to take in. I mean, there were certainly a lot of people who were listing the classics, who were like, she should watch Aliens. Mm-hmm. She should watch,
Of course.
She'll
see that in school, though.
If I can say, the horror movie people are like the romance people. They just want to share. They just want to share their stuff. And so I thought it was great that you gave them a chance to do that.
It's also a nice example of that is not a topic because we are not horror movie people.
Right. We just happen not to bump into it.
Not to bump into it. And as I'm looking over the list, I'm seeing tons and tons and tons of movies I love.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be, I think, a nice way for us to break into a topic that people have been begging us to talk about for a while.
Agreed.
So that's one, the incredible kindness and generosity of our listeners who are doing my daughter and myself a tremendous favor. The other thing is, speaking of a tremendous favor, over the weekend, my pal Linda Holmes came over to my house, hung out in my living room, and just sat the family down and had us watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Boom!
Now, we have talked about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Linda has talked about Brooklyn Nine-Nine on this show before. I have not because I had never seen it.
Yeah.
I had only heard that it was fun. Mm-hmm. I like Andy Samberg. I think I like Andy Samberg more than you did going into that show.
Mm-hmm.
Just crack it open. The first two seasons in their entirety are on Hulu Plus.
Mm-hmm.
We will barrel through and then barrel through again because it is so rewatchable.
Very rewatchable.
That's perfect background TV.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Terrific show.
Andy Samberg, Andre Brower.
Oh, the wonderful
Terry Crews, the wonderful Chelsea Peretti. It is such a good cast.
Terry Crews is the family favorite so far.
Makes sense.
Good choice, good pick. Excellent. Well, Stephen, I really like your pick.
Of
the thing I got you to watch. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I've talked about Review on Comedy Central before. It is well into its second season, mm-hmm. and it is nailing it. As I think I mentioned before, there is a strong thread of cringe comedy in the show, and that's not going to be for everybody. But as I think I said before, nothing good is. Andy Daly plays Forrest McDeal, and the show's conceit is that he is reviewing life experiences.
Yes.
As he says at the beginning of each episode, life, it's literally all we have, but is it any good? You know, he'll review experiences like joining a cult, going to an orgy, eating 15 pancakes. And as the show goes on...
I've only done one of those things.
It gets more surreal, it gets bigger, and of course, in the process, he is so dedicated to doing this job that he proceeds to destroy his life. For you to buy that, there's so much on Andy Daly's shoulders. The waters that he plays in as an actor, as a comedian, is cheerful, sunny, that doesn't quite hide the really dark underneath it. And something that Emily Nussbaum pointed out in The New Yorker, I think last week, is that this show is really about being a critic. It's not necessarily professionally, but being the kind of person who keeps a part of themselves held back, who doesn't join in, who observes, and has a very strict aesthetic that is sort of an evaluative stance, let's say. Mm-hmm. This show speaks to me, and it is hilarious. So that's Review on Comedy Central. Do it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what's making you happy this week?
Well, you know, I'm a middlebrow guy, so I got a highbrow one, a lowbrow one, so that they will meet and resolve into a do.
Nice.
Highbrow right first. Oliver Sacks, the pioneering neurologist and writer, just died. And I read a beautiful profile of him this morning by Steve Silberman that was originally published in Wired in 2004. The title of that piece is The Fully Immersive Mind of Oliver Sacks. Google it. Easy to find. Just a beautifully written, informative piece, sort of profile I aspire to be able to write. Wonderful. Lowbrow. James Bonding, the podcast that Glenn recommended on this podcast 2 years ago when hosts Matt Gourley and Matt Myra were going to go through the James Bond filmography, one film per week. They've gotten a little sidetracked. Mm. Matt Gourley hosts a lot of other podcasts, yes, including the wonderful I Was There Too.
Ooh, like that one. Love that one.
For the first episode in many months, he has his superego buddies, James Bladen and Mark McConville, in the studio, which is very, very funny. And the film under examination is Octopussy, which is kind of a low light of the Bond franchise, but when the Bond films are at their worst is when James Bonding is at its very best.
Nice.
Also, Matt Gourley, for whatever reason, did not eat anything all day prior to taping this one, which makes his already kind of surreal sense of humor even weirder as he succumbs to low blood sugar over the course of 2 hours and 10 minutes. So I recommend the Octopussy episode of James Bonding.
Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. I'll say two things. First of all, like Stephen, I had an experience this past week with the generosity of our listeners, in this case around the fact that last week at this time I talked about a music podcast called Switched on Pop, and I have gotten such enthusiastic, very nice response to that. That if you ever want to feel like really good about your life, like that you have some purpose, connect people with not your thing, but someone else's thing, that's much cooler. So that's been really nice. And the people who've talked to me about it have just been lovely. And also then, this is the simplest of simple, and it's not a super new thing. It's been kicking around for a while, but I was showing again at this same summit with the Thompson family where we were watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I was showing them this video of this dude at IKEA.
Oh my god.
So it's this guy and he's walking around an IKEA and he keeps picking up the tags because of course everything at IKEA has a Swedish name or a Swedish sounding name. I'm not sure whether all of them are real words, but
like the Borg.
He picks them up and like, and then he makes some sort of terrible pun.
Terrible.
Off of the name of the thing.
Hey, Donna, I've got you on my radar. Hey, Donna, do you think these pot plants are risk or not? Hey, Donna, this clock looks pretty smick.
Oh, stop.
One point he just holds one up and says, and it's just N-O-T. And, he's like, and usually they have this, hey, Donna. But this one he just says, not.
Glenn pointed this out, but it's very much true. The thing that sells it for me is the way he, every single time, he says to his poor girlfriend, I assume girlfriend, hey, Donna. And so, because you do start to want to say to people, hey, Donna.
Hey,
like,
Donna.
Every time we have a stupid joke.
We've already done it since.
And what wound up selling it, I think, is that, and the fact that it has this weird warmth to it because she is so patient, and yet she knows that her role there is to just stand there while he makes all these horrible, he gives all these horrible puns to her. She's just taking it because she knows she has no choice. And she sort of starts to adopt this pose of like, how long is this going to go on? Uh-huh. And the more she kind of is like, what are you even doing? The funnier he thinks it is and the more he does it. So it's just a silly YouTube video, oh, but so boy, it made me laugh. And I watched that video on a day when I was not able to laugh at anything. And I giggled so hard that the next day, a woman I ran into in the bathroom here at NPR said to me, what were you laughing at? She doesn't work right near me. She works elsewhere on the floor. And she said, what were you laughing at yesterday? And I realized it could only be, hey, Donna.
There was only one choice.
Yeah. Hey, Donna.
The tiny pony one is where it just goes into the stratosphere.
You'll just have to watch. We will definitely provide that for you. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Chris at CT Klimek. That's K-L-I-M-E-K. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to you all for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.